to tell you that actually Professor Nostradal and I have in common the fact we were both born in Mexico, but not only that, we actually went to the same kindergarten. It was actually the German school, Alexander von Humboldt, so we coincided there. So from that time, it was very clear to me that Jorge was very interested in quasi-Newton methods and updates and patience and all of that, so he kept that interest. Now, on a more serious note, so he did his undergraduate degree in Mexico City, in physics at the National University in Mexico, UNAM. Then he went to Rice University, where he obtained his degree in mathematics. This was in 1978. And then after that, he actually was at UNAM, assistant professor for, two or three years. Then he moved to the Grant Institute at NYU in New York, and then joined Northwestern University in 1983. And he's currently there, the Walter Murphy professor, and again in the Department of Industrial Engineering and Management Science. In fact, until recently, he was department chair there. And I should also mention that, of course, you know, Jorge Nostradal is extremely well known in the area of optimization. He's done a lot of work, especially in nonlinear optimization, including things like conjugate directions, quasi-Newton methods, limited memory, BFGS, entry point methods that gave rise, for example, to the K-Nitro codes. Actually, I guess also some of the hardware codes are his. And then also work on trust regions. And in fact, he's also collaborated, if I remember correctly, with Larry Beager, or at least has had, in that sense, also close interaction with him. He's also worked in stochastic programming, in scientific computing, and more recently in machine learning. The thing that's interesting is, especially in the area of nonlinear optimization, he's really had a huge impact with a book that he wrote with Steve Wright. In fact, I just checked, and he has 25,000 Google Scholar citations from that book. So that's become really, I would say, the Bible of nonlinear optimization. It's really an extremely nice book. The other thing about him is talking about also publications. He's produced over 100 and has actually a total of 50,000 Google Scholar citations, which in fact that earned him in 2004 the ISI Highly Cited Researcher in the area of mathematics. He's editor, chief editor of SIAM Journal of Optimization, associate editor of mathematical programming. And because of all the work, great work that he's done, he's received a number of very important distinctions. He received the Charles Freuden Prize, very appropriately. This is from Optimization Methods and Software Journal. 2010, he became a fellow of SIAM. Then in 2012, he received a very prestigious award, namely the George Stancic Prize Award from SIAM. And then also, more recently, was an extremely prestigious award, which is the John von Neumann Award, John von Neumann in Theory. This is from INFORM. So just to give you as a point of reference, Professor Egon Balas was also, for example, recipient of that award. So that gives you an idea of the caliber of Jorge. And recently, he's taken an interest in machine learning and topics of that sort, but especially connecting them to the area of optimization. And today, he'll be talking to us about nonlinear optimization for machine learning. So, Jorge, it's all yours. Welcome here to Carnegie Mellon. Okay.
Thank you very much, Ignacio. A lot of things happened since kindergarten, I suppose, but it's all been fun. Great. So, I'm going to start with a question here for everybody. What do we really know? This is a very strange time. You have to choose one of these answers. Deep neural networks are poised to impact a host new set of applications. They're just beginning. Or neural networks have almost run their course and will produce little beyond what's currently been achieved, which has been impressive, but maybe that's it. Or neural networks will be replaced by simpler prediction systems that are easier to understand and interpret. This is the situation where we are in, as far as I can see. We just don't know. Now, from the point of view of optimization, training deep neural networks is done through solving a nonlinear optimization problem. And this has been done essentially with the same optimization algorithms for the last 25 years. If you ask Jan LeCun, this is what he's been doing. And there has been maybe small changes the stochastic gradient with momentum, perhaps, but this has been essentially the technology that has helped the creation of deep neural networks. Without them, training would not be possible. Now, what's going on? Deep neural networks are very complex functions. They're nonlinear and non-convex. They're high-dimensional. And they're so high-dimensional and nonlinear that we don't really understand why the training process actually works as well as it does. More questions when we try to understand why does the optimization work? More questions arise every year instead of more answers. And promising algorithmic ideas that come from different communities, from the optimization community or from the machine learning community, are often challenged and sort of disproven in certain ways. The state of the art is that their heuristics are governing things. Batch normalization, for instance, has helped optimization greatly, and new architectures like residual neural networks were designed, according to the authors, in order to facilitate optimization. In the end, they ended up giving much better results. Given all of this, should we try to develop new algorithms for training deep neural networks? So that's the central question of this talk. We wrote a survey paper that Ignacio alluded to, appeared in SIAM Review with Leon Botou and Frank Curtis. And in that survey article, what we did is two things. There were two parts saying, well, the foundations of machine learning depends on the stochastic gradient method. Therefore, let us tell you all what we know about this method, including its mathematical properties. Let's describe them as quickly as possible. And part two, if you want to go beyond the stochastic gradient method, these are the directions that maybe one can follow. These are our suggestions. So at this point, you can read that article and say, well, for 25 years, people have used the stochastic gradient method. Let's just decide that this area is closed. Optimization for deep neural networks is closed, and let's move on to something else. So given this, is there any need of looking more at optimization? And for many, the answer is no. I take a different view. So although training deep neural networks seems so difficult, and it's currently so empirical and heuristic, doing this research provides information and the opportunity for revisiting some ideas. For example, momentum is currently used almost universally in conjunction with the stochastic gradient method. Why is momentum used there? As I'm going to argue in a little bit, this is very strange. Now, this work also suggested the development of new algorithms like variance reductions, they are bound to be useful in other domains. So it's good to look at machine learning problems because the objective functions have a form of stochastic functions that occur in other domains. So algorithms that may work, they're attempting to improve neural networks, are likely to work in other domains. Now, studying optimization methods for neural networks poses interesting trade-offs between computational and statistical efficiency that need to be answered. So a question that is going to be central is the following. I can construct optimization algorithms that are efficient for training problems. Are they also giving me solutions that have good statistical generalization properties? Since when are the two things connected? How are they connected? This is new. At least this was for me. Now, more specific questions. Is the highly noisy and Markovian nature of the stochastic gradient method essential in training neural networks? Do you have to have a noisy iteration? If not, is there a way to achieve statistical efficiency, meaning good learning algorithms, and obtaining a high level of parallelism that dramatically reduces training time? Well, the current view is that for training deep neural networks, algorithms whose iterates are random variables and are allowed to wander around the solution perform a more effective exploration of the data and produce solutions with better generalization than classical gradient-based methods that use a large batch. So that picture that shows that wiggly behavior of the iterates It's one that you would think in terms of global optimization is a useful technique for moving away maybe stationary points and going to minimizers. Well, that's a picture. It doesn't mean that that corresponds to reality. But the fact is that noisy algorithms have proved to be quite effective. Now, the problem with stochastic gradient method is that it's a first-order method and will always suffer from ill condition. Every first-order method suffers from ill condition. Second, the simple Markovian iteration of SGD is difficult to parallelize. So the idea is that you're making steps, and every step is independent of the previous step. Every step has just collecting new information and moves there. This makes it very difficult to parallelize. I mean, one can get a certain amount of speed up, but you cannot get a speed up of 1,000 by throwing thousands of machines. So something we've been looking at is to come up with a different kind of algorithms where you're not either in the purely noisy or purely deterministic regime, but use an increasingly accurate gradient with a much larger batch as the iteration progresses, and in this way enable parallelism and also the use of second-order information. So this seems like a very reasonable idea. This is an idea that has occurred in stochastic optimization and simulation for a really long time. If you want to solve a stochastic optimization problem, maybe you sample little in the beginning, get an inaccurate gradient, and then as you progress, you keep increasing the accuracy of the gradient, and then you converge to the solution. A very natural idea. But there are a number of things that happened when this was tried. Very oddly, if you use a method with a very large batch size, it leads to generalization problems. The solutions obtained by the stochastic gradient method have been seen to generalize better than those obtained with a fixed large size. This has been observed for many years empirically, and a dozen of recent studies have confirmed this. The optimization algorithm should be a good learning method. So what is it that I have known? For instance, Yann LeCun, who's one of the leaders in neural networks, has told me for many, many years, I know that you developed a limited memory quasi-Newton method, and I tried it early on, and it didn't work. And I tried stochastic gradient method, and it works. And I ask him, what does it mean that way it doesn't work? Well, I get better solutions. I get better solutions if I use the stochastic gradient method. And better solutions by him means better generalization. Because someone who works in machine learning takes a training set, runs an optimization algorithm, but doesn't look at the performance of the optimization algorithm in the training set. He's just looking at the performance on out of sample, on generalization. And that's where they see a difference, right? So that has been observed for a long time. A noisy stochastic algorithm is going to get better solutions. A batch algorithm is going to be poorer solutions. Why? We can discuss things, but the truth is that it's not really understood. I think theoreticians are trying to work that out. It's a fact, and probably definitely true, but it's not well understood. So the story gets really complicated, and therefore it's good to start at the beginning. I need to talk about what are neural networks, what is the optimization problem, and let's look carefully at these questions of where we stand and how we move forward. So let me see if anybody has any question at this point.
I think it's okay. You have a question? Okay, sure.
Hey, you may go into this more, but has anyone considered dynamically changing the batch size as time has progressed, or is it only considered fixed?
That's exactly what's going to come later on. So the answer is yes, and if you wait a little bit, it will be there. Great. So thank you. Let me go on then. First of all, deep neural networks. Why are people so excited about deep neural networks? Everybody's heard about them. They've had spectacular success on perceptual tasks. This is what I find particularly interesting, tasks that the human brain does, like image and speech recognition. Also machine translation, they have an enormous impact on the field. They are a different, completely different type of machine learning system that had been used before. There had been an emphasis on creating convex models like logistic regression, support vector machines. Now, out of the blue, people are coming up with a prediction system that is not only not convex, but it's extremely nonlinear. So if you look at the feedforward neural network, a picture there, which is the simplest network, nobody uses that really anymore, but it's the simplest network. And if the activation functions are piecewise linear functions, ReLUs, if you have seven layers, then the function is pretty much a polynomial, a 17-degree polynomial in, let's say, if you have a million inputs in a million variables. So a polynomial in a million variables of degree 17 seems like an enormously complicated beast. So this is what people came up with. Now, why is this impressive? Well, there's a lot of hype. People talk a lot about hype. But let me tell you what made a huge impression on me. I was collaborating with people doing speech recognition before neural networks took off in 2009. Doing speech recognition is, of course, a very difficult thing. You get acoustic waves, and from there you have to come up with a text, right? This very complex problem not only was improved by neural networks, but neural networks took over the whole process, feature engineering, what they call end-to-end. So when that happened, I thought, sometimes engineers do kludgy things. Sometimes there is good luck. This is not good luck. This is not a kludge. There is something deep going on. Perhaps they're very complicated, but they're capturing some really important underlying structures and making really good prediction. Now, they're working very well on some applications, but why is not well understood. For example, in statistical learning, there's a concept of overfitting. If you use something that is too complex, you're going to get overfitting. It's going to work poorly out of sample. And neural networks do not do that. People keep increasing the capacity of the neural network by making them broader and wider. In other words, by having more and more parameters to tune. They keep making them bigger and bigger, and the quality of the generalization, the quality of out-of-sample solutions does not diminish. So on the left-hand side, I have some results from a paper from this year, Novak. On the left, you can see the generalization gap. You're trying different neural networks for a particular task. On the x-axis is the number of weights. So you look at many neural networks, more and more capacity, and you see that there is a trend. The trend, there is not an upwards trend. Overfitting means that as you go to the right, to the 1B, you would have a curve going up. Instead, it seems to be going down. The data seems to be going down. This contradicts statistical learning theory. It's a part that is not well understood. All right, so now let's be precise about this. The notation is going to be the following. X are the features, Y are the labels. We want to find a prediction function that depends on some unknown parameter W. In this case, we're only going to be thinking about nonlinear prediction functions, like a neural network. We consider a loss function, such as cross-entropy, that is going to measure the difference between your predictions and the true labels. And the training problem consists of solving the optimization problem, which is minimizing the losses plus a regularization term over all the data points that you have. This is the training problem, and it's solved with respect to the parameters. So for each weight that we have in the neural network, the optimization algorithm is going to have to find out a good value for it to minimize that objective function. Now, in order to simplify the notation, the composition of the loss function and the prediction function, since each one of them depends on the data point, we're going to call them just F of WXIYI. And so we can write the empirical risk, the training objective function, as a sum of functions, Fi. Each I there depends on a data point. So it's a sum of functions problem. Now, that's a training problem. The real problem, the real machine learning problem, is to minimize the loss over the entire population. So I've written that as capital F, and there's a random variable there that depends on choosing data over the whole population. So I'm going to contrast two objective functions, the expected risk, which is the true risk, and that's the risk of the entire population, and the empirical risk, which is the one obtained using the data that you have available. Now, there are algorithms that become very popular. They're good at solving the finite sum problem, but do not generalize well, like SAG and SAGA. Maybe someone is going to ask me about those. And those are really interesting, really creative, innovative algorithms that are very good for using the, for solving the sum finite sum problem, but do not work so well in terms of generalization. I'll have a graph on that. So I will not talk about those methods anymore. And so our goal is to minimize the true objective function. All right, so since the objective there at the top of the slide is the sum of functions, we can construct an approximation to the gradient. This is the idea of the stochastic gradient method. Form a gradient by choosing only some of those component functions. So choose a subset of all the training data uniformly and independently. It could be just one. The set X could just have one. Now, sample such a gradient and form an approximation to the gradient, grad F sub XK, which is simply the sample approximation of the gradients that you've sampled there. And then move along that direction on the right-hand side. The stochastic gradient method then moves along the direction of this approximate gradient, it's the Planck alpha. And then you have a continuum. If the size of the sample is one, you have the simplest stochastic gradient algorithm. You choose a whole training set, then you have a batch method that really is obsessed in just that training problem and minimizes that training problem as well as possible. So now the question that came just a while ago, why not use an increasingly accurate gradient with a much larger batch size so as to get better algorithms? So this idea that we've been promoting for a while of using dynamic increasing samples is gaining traction. But people have discovered what Jan de Kun has known for some time. So here we have a graph that plots the results of many optimization runs. So on the x-axis, we label the size of the mini batch used in the stochastic gradient method. And you ran the stochastic gradient method many, many times for different mini batches. On the left-hand side is the accuracy, the out-of-sample error. And you see that, you know, if you solve the problem with a stochastic optimization algorithm to completion, and you solve it again with another stochastic optimization algorithm to completion, every time with better grade, fixed batch size, the final accuracy that you get is the same for all those values, except once the batch size becomes very well, there is a loss in accuracy. And in this graph is from 8K on, the batch size increases. Now, something that is important about this, and this is written in the paper by Goyal He, the title of the paper is Reducing Training Time from 29 Hours to 1 Hour for the ImageNet Competition. So what they were able to do is by moving away from standard values of batch sizes, 256, 500, to 8K, 8,000 elements to approximate the gradient, they were able to use the GPUs more efficiently and brought down training time from 29 hours to 1 hour. Well, this is an indication of the potential that was there by moving away from this purely so noisy iteration. But this is also an indication that things are complicated, that we cannot just keep increasing the batch size because out-of-sample performance is deteriorated. So we have to somehow navigate between these two. Okay, so we have been proposing that instead of using a big fixed batch size, which we know once it's big enough, it's not effective, to gradually increase it. And the question is it possible to obtain the two desirable objectives? Find a good out-of-sample predictor, and second, parallelize the iteration, construct gradients that are sufficiently accurate so as to incorporate second-order information in the problem. Okay, now, we cannot advance if we don't really understand why this stochastic gradient method works. Why does it converge? Why does the stochastic gradient method converge in, for what classes of functions? What do we know? Does our theory actually cover deep neural networks, or is the use of the stochastic gradient methods in deep neural networks purely heuristic? Well, I'm going to have just three equations here, but I think they're very important. To prove convergence of the deterministic nonlinear optimization algorithm, one writes down three lines using a Taylor expansion and prove that any gradient-based method gives you a reduction in function that is proportional to the size of the gradient. That makes a lot of sense. Any gradient method away from the solution is going to give you a large decrease in the objective function. When you get close to the solution, of course, you cannot decrease the function very much, but the gradient is also very small, so everything is compatible. So the decrease is proportional to the norm of the gradient and the step length. So all you have to make sure is that the step length is not really terrible to prevent you from making progress. Now, for stochastic optimization problem that I've written there, what I call the true problem, which is to minimize the expectation of the whole population, five lines of analysis show you that the stochastic gradient method gives you the following bound on its behavior. First, on the left-hand side, we do not talk anymore about the decrease in the objective function, but the expected decrease in the objective function. And this relationship here is the behavior at a given iteration. At a given iteration, we choose at random a sample and take a step. This is the expected value of that particular optimization algorithm. And it says that there are two terms. The expected decrease depends on the norm of the true gradient, not the approximate gradient, squared, just as we had in deterministic optimization, which is great. So there's definitely a drift term, a term that is going to make things better. But then there's a positive term, the last term on the right-hand side, the second moment. This is really the variance in the error in the stochastic approximation. Instead of using the true error of the objective function, capital F, you're using an approximation of it, and the variance of this approximation is entering there as a positive term that is hurting progress, is preventing progress from happening. So that is a key relationship when analyzing the stochastic gradient method. I wrote it here for strictly convex objective functions. And the stochastic gradient method was proposed by Robbins and Mondrow in 1951. And already then, they noticed that that relationship has alpha k and alpha k squared. So the bad term, the one that hurts you, has an alpha k squared term. Therefore, if you make alpha small enough, you can make the negative term dominate over the positive term and get convergence. And that's there. Beautiful in the Robbins-Monroe paper, if alpha k goes to zero sufficiently rapidly, this method will converge. That is the case, provided that your estimate is an unbiased estimator of the true gradient. Now, in practice, to choose step lengths that go to zero is not a good idea, because if you don't tune them large, just exactly the right way, you're going to make very small progress, right? So in practice, what people do is a constant step length for some number of iterations and then decrease it as necessary, and that is going to give very good performance in practice. And there's some very nice analysis, and the summary of it is given in our Spanian review paper. One can show that if you apply the stochastic gradient method with a fixed step length, you converge to a neighborhood of the solution at a linear rate. You converge quickly to a neighborhood of the solution, not to the solution, some ball around the solution. So therefore, what you can do is run the stochastic gradient method when you see it slow down, decrease the step length, and then you convert to a smaller neighborhood at a linear rate. And that's pretty much the practice today in training neural networks, a sequence of diminishing step lengths. So in the picture, on the right-hand side, you see the classical Robbins-Monroe algorithm. It will convert to the solution, but the steps are getting smaller and smaller. And on the left-hand side, you have fixed step lengths where the noise of the iteration is never diminished to zero. There's always noise in the iteration, and therefore, at some point, you just wander around the solution without being able to converge. Okay, so that relation tells us that there is this variance that is hurting us. Now, where can we go? So the optimization panorama that we proposed there in that paper with Jumbo 2 and Frank Curtis tries to depict things in a very nerdy engineering way. I hope there would be a more elegant way to do that. But it's a coordinate axis. In the origin, you have the stochastic gradient method. So everything is going to start from this stochastic gradient method. And there are two directions. One arrow shows the direction towards batch methods, and the other one is towards Newton methods. Well, what it really shows is that you can take the stochastic gradient method and try to start reducing its variance, the variance in the error in the gradient approximation. And on the other direction is, can you start incorporating second-order information? So the equation at the bottom of the slide in blue has the variance term, the term that hurts you. And there are two ways of controlling the damage done by that term. One is by making alpha small enough. We don't want to do that. We want to take large steps. So the other way to reduce that is by making the term in blue smaller. Let's make the gradients more accurate. Let's reduce the variance. And let's do it in a clever enough way so that, again, the balance that Robbins and Monroe found, we can find it, but by sampling at the right rate. Okay, so we can also do Newton-type iterations, but I'm going to skip that for a moment. And I'm going to present the following result that I think you may find interesting. So suppose you consider a gradient-like iteration. Every time you move along a stochastic gradient approximation, that's what Nabla f of x is. So you may have a small batch size, or you may have a large batch size. So the question is such a method competitive with the stochastic gradient method? And just as a background, I have to tell you that for many years, theoreticians in the convex optimization community and machine learning community have studied the stochastic gradient method and fallen in love with it. So you would hear in many talks saying, since the stochastic gradient method is optimal, blah, blah, blah. And they could prove, it's easy to prove, that for a convex function of a stochastic nature under reasonable conditions, if you look at total amount of work that a stochastic gradient method takes to get you to the solution, compared to a pure gradient method, it is superior. And it is superior in the sense that the stochastic gradient method, the amount of work is independent of the dimension of the problem. And that's not the case for the gradient method. So there's a beautiful paper by Botou and Bousquet called The Trade-Offs of Machine Learning, where they summarize all those properties and they say that the stochastic gradient method has better complexity properties than the pure gradient method. And they have a sentence saying, well, isn't it interesting that the best optimization algorithms are not the best training algorithms? You know, meaning, well, what I just said, right? But so the question was this. They were showing that purely stochastic is better than purely batch. But in our work with Richard Burt and my students, we decided to ask the following question. Is it possible to design a method that dynamically changes the sample size and has a complexity which is as good as a stochastic gradient method? And the answer was yes. And the answer is pretty simple. The theorem says the following. If you choose a step length in a standard way, B means that there's no Hessian approximation. And C says geometric increase. If you take the sample size and increase it at a geometric rate, then you get a linear rate of convergence, and the complexity, the total amount of work that this algorithm will do, is comparable to that of the stochastic gradient method. So you can no longer say that SGD is the optimal method. There are challengers there. Now, this is a theory. In theory, you just have to grow things geometrically. There's also nice work by Mark Schmidt and Michael Friedlander. They come up with similar results, and probably that result was known in some of the other communities. But what we found, of course, is that those theoretical results cannot be used in practice. You never want to use an algorithm whose decision depends on the iteration counter, S to the K. You need ideas that are algorithmic, that respond to what you observe in the problem. So what we proposed is statistical tests. And I'm going to go fast over that, over this. The idea is simply the following. You have a stochastic approximation to the gradient, and you keep decreasing the true objective function. In principle, isn't it the case that when the variance in your approximation is large compared to the true size of the gradient, it's time to decrease the variance? You don't want a variance that is as large as the vector itself. So this is done through the test that I have over there, can be written in expectation. What it says is keep the sample size the same as long as that quantity in there is a variance and your approximation is small enough. This is a test that we proposed. Other people, we discovered that actually it's too aggressive. And therefore, we have a second idea. And we said, look, all what you need is for your stochastic gradient approximation to be a descent direction. So let's only require descent in expectation. And that's the second line. Increase the sample size fast enough so that in expectation you get descent direction. And that is written mathematically the way we have it there, and there are some sample average approximations to work with that. So in any case, we have two practical criteria for running an algorithm that will automatically decide when the sample size should be increased, when the quality of the gradient should be increased. We have proposed this, and the pictures associated with them are the following. You want your stochastic approximations to be in a ball of the true gradient. That's the first test that we proposed, a little bit restricted. And the second one says, we just want to have descent directions. We have analyzed, we have tested these algorithms. And I'm going to show you in a moment some results that I find exciting when combining these ideas with second-order information. But I thought that this was maybe a moment to see if there are questions.
Any questions? I think that's okay, Jorge.
Yeah, we're good. There's no question from the audience here. Professor? Hello?
I cannot hear.
Yeah, I guess we are good.
Yeah, if someone is speaking, I cannot hear.
Yeah, hi. Question from the audience, remote audience?
Okay.
Yes, just please go on with it. We'll mute now.
Should I go on, or should he or she go on?
Yes, please. I think there's no question from the remote audience, too.
All right, so we'll go on. Okay,
pause. Please.
Let's talk a little bit about step length. So you have an optimization algorithm, it's a descent direction, and every time you have a descent direction, you have to decide how far to go. Now, when you're standing at a point and you're looking at the direction that you know is a descent direction and you can measure the gradient, does that tell you how far to go? Well, no, not really, right? Because The function could look in one of those two different ways. It depends on the curvature of the problem. You may want to go very far, or maybe you cannot go very far along that direction. So that's one thing that tells you that for every direction that you have to be careful with step length. And maybe one way to get the algorithm to work better is to have different scales along different directions. the picture here shows what you really, really know. You want to somehow deviate the direction by choosing different step lengths along different directions so that you don't have this very a dumb behavior of the stochastic gradient method that goes to zigzag. Now, in theory, in a lot of the papers, what you see is they say, well, let's choose the step length to be one of the Lipschitz constants. What is the Lipschitz constant? The Lipschitz constant is the highest curvature that the function has in any direction. So if you choose the step length always to be fixed and less than one of the highest curvature that you've ever seen, you're never going to overshoot. Along every search direction, you're going to be able to obtain a decrease in the objective function. But of course, the price to pay is that if you are currently moving along a direction where the curvature is not the largest, you're going to cut your step unnecessarily. So a lot of the theory, 99% of the theory that's written in convex analysis is written for fixed step length, because analyzing dynamic step lengths is really, really hard. But not because using step lengths is not a good idea in practice. In fact, it is, right? And so a lot of the work done in machine learning has actually been trying to address this question of the step length. There are two methods called Adagrad and Adam that try to find dynamically a diagonal matrix that will scale the gradient based on historical information on the problem, and these methods have become very popular. I will get back to Adam because it probably has an interpretation that is different from the one that most people think of what it is. So instead of finding sophisticated step length strategies, we find a method that produces well-scaled directions. Now, once you have a well-scaled direction, if you have a matrix GK, as in that case, then the choice of the step length is no longer so important. And Ignacio mentioned that I suffered from this quasi-Newton disease. I've had that for my whole life. And one of the reasons why I suffer from that is that if you have a gradient method, you never know what is the scale of the direction. But quasi-Newton methods, for some reasons that are understood, that are beautiful, are able not only to get good directions, but good scales. You don't worry about the step length anymore. The unit step length is usually what works. So it is very appealing to say the machine learning community has been looking for diagonal scaling matrices in order to get rid of the problem of choosing the step length. However, diagonal scaling matrices are very strange objects. It implies knowledge of along certain coordinates. Instead of that, we know by borrowing from the nonlinear optimization community that one can learn curvature about the problem using a full Hessian approximation instead, and not committing to knowledge along specific feature. So we're going to explore that. So the ideal iteration would be to do a Newton method that is in red, but that is not practical. For an application with a million variables, you cannot do that. You can try to do subsampling of the Hessian, an inexact Newton approach. There is a Fisher information matrix developed at the University of Toronto that uses a series of approximations. And one can use quasi-Newton approximations in a way that I will describe soon. Okay, so I want to make one observation about the use of second-order information, which I think is one that I always remember, and which is very important. What is a Newton step? In what direction does it go? Well, let's write down the Hessian matrix. Let's write down the eigenvalue decomposition of the Hessian matrix. So every symmetric positive definite matrix can be written as a summation of lambda I VI VI transpose, where VIs are the eigenvectors. So we know that. Hessian is symmetric, that is the case. So now, the inverse of a Hessian has an eigenvalue decomposition, which has the same, except the eigenvalues have become reciprocal. All right, so there's the eigen decomposition of the inverse Hessian. Now, the Newton step is the multiplication of the inverse Hessian times the gradient. So what does that mean? So when you multiply that summation times the gradient, you have a term in square brackets where the last square bracket is missing, in bracket where the last bracket is missing. What you see is that the search direction is a linear combination of the eigenvectors of the Hessian, where there's more weight on the smallest eigenvalue, 1 over lambda I. The smaller the lambda I, the more emphasis that eigenvector will have. Therefore, the Newton direction is heavily biased along the eigenvectors corresponding to the smallest eigenvalues. If you could estimate those, you could have a very good estimate of the Newton direction. You don't have to have them all. And there is a picture where I have these things. Now, the problem is that approximating the smallest eigenvalues is the most difficult thing. And the best thing that we have is not using stochastic gradients, but nobody's been able to improve upon the conjugate gradient method, which is a way of approximating the Newton direction of going through that span of eigenvectors. It does it more or less in a monotonic way, starting with the subspaces corresponding to the largest eigenvalues and moving towards the direction of the Newton step in a gradual way. This will also work in a non-convex setting. So one can incorporate, one can do this using Hessian approximation, approximate the Hessian using subsampling. So that's what I have in this slide. If the function is a sum of functions, the gradient is a sum of gradients, the Hessian is a sum of Hessians, and therefore in the framed iteration is a Newton-like iteration where instead of the true Hessian with samples and elements of the Hessian, we're not going to factor that. Instead, you apply the conjugate gradient to solve that problem, which means you're going to do products of these sample Hessians, and the work is going to be smaller, the smaller the number of subsample Hessians you have. You can apply a Newton method like that, a subsample Newton method, which has become quite popular, and people have done lots of experiments with that. It has a lot of potential. All right, so this is independent of the dynamic sampling that I mentioned. So the stochastic nature of the objective function allows you to try to mimic Newton's method by subsampling the Hessian and then doing conjugate gradient inexact solve to compute an approximate solution of that system. So we have those two pieces. You could put them together and get a great algorithm. We've experimented with that for a while, and that's what I wanted to do. I did not want to do quasi-Newton. I wanted to do a subsample Newton method. But things don't work out the way you want. What happened? One of my students came to my office one day, and he said, "We have been doing subsample Newton methods for a while. But Professor, what do you think? Wouldn't it be better to do a quasi-Newton algorithm? We have not tried those." And I told my student, "It's interesting that you asked that, because that's what I was just thinking this morning. When you look at the iteration counts, I bet the quasi-Newton algorithm is going to win." And the student went back and gave me what are the next two slides, which I found really surprising. So quasi-Newton methods have been a major idea in nonlinear optimization. They're used throughout. They scale well with the dimension of the problem. They're only linear in the dimension of the problem. They find the inverse Hessian approximation HK directly. And the basic idea is that instead of finding majorizing functions, if you look at the work of Nesterov and Nemirovsky, which is geared to finding optimal complexity of algorithms and ends up focusing on first order methods, all that work is based on finding majorizing functions. Quasi-Newton methods, what they do is they do interpolation. They interpolate function and gradient information and do a more accurate approximation to the function. they do not have better complexity properties, because in the worst case, Nesterov and Nemirovsky can always find new problems where methods like that are not going to be better. But those examples are the ones you're almost never going to run into practice. What you see in practice is much better behavior for algorithms that are able to interpolate function and gradient information, because they're going to give you a better model of the objective function. That's what, in essence, quasi-Newton methods do. They compute changes in displacements and gradients, update a Hessian approximation, and in that way, they compute a search direction. So what my student did, his name here is Bola Pargada, is he came and he said, I'm going to do a progressive sampling, dynamic sampling algorithm with a quasi-Newton approximation that is done in a careful way. So remember, we're talking about approximate gradients. They're noisy. So one has to do something that is fault-tolerant. You don't want to create approximations, interpolation, that is going to lead to concave models as opposed to convex models. You don't want to do an update of the quasi-Newton matrix that is corrupted because it will stay there. But we studied this separately. So there's a way to carefully update quasi-Newton methods in a fault-tolerant way. And that was done in this example. In addition to that, we're going to deviate from all the conventional wisdom in machine learning, and we're going to do a line search. Once we have a search direction, we make sure that we decrease the function sufficiently. In other words, exploit as much as possible the directions that you have. This is not wise when you're doing an extremely cheap stochastic gradient iteration. It makes sense as the sample size has increased and you've invested a good amount in computing a search direction. Okay, so just coming up towards the end of this presentation, for many years, what we observed is that the machine learning community was right. Their intuition, their experience, and their observations about optimization methods were right, even for a logistic regression problem. And what I'm presenting there in that slide is a logistic regression problem using some speech data I got from Google many years ago. It's not a very large problem, maybe 100,000 variables. And what you see there is that if you run the stochastic gradient method to minimize the logistic function and you tune it well, so the red line is the stochastic gradient method after done 20 or 30 times where you've been adjusting the step length so that it worked well. And on the blue line is some batch method, a true gradient method, or even quasi-Newton BFGS, any methods of that kind. They lose. The stochastic gradient method makes progress quickly, so fast, it's so cheap, that it beats the batch algorithm, hands down. Later on, once it actually gets small, you can see that the blue line gets better, but by that time, maybe it's not so interesting anymore. So that's what we observed for many years of experimenting with many methods, and when my students came in and showed me this result, then I thought that something really interesting was happening. Now, this result may look a little bit messy, but let me just emphasize the following. We need to look in dark blue at the stochastic gradient method. Tuned very carefully, again, the logistic regression problem, so it has a unique solution, and we don't have to worry about those questions of generalization. So the stochastic gradient method initially decreases the objective function really quickly, and then it stagnates as the noise dominates. Then in red and in light blue are the progressive batching PD, QN, quasi-Newton methods, progressive batching, with two different strategies for doing fault tolerance that I will not explain. Two different variants, they work almost the same. Now, the key thing is that you can no longer see where the blue line is, because the initial behavior of these progressive batching algorithms is just as good as that of the stochastic gradient method. But once the stochastic gradient method gets into the noisy regime, then these algorithms still continue to progress. And we're using the adaptive sampling strategies that I described there to sample variance approximations to decide when to increase the sample size. Now, I also plotted there the SVRG method, the stochastic variance reduced method that has become so popular, you see that it starts slowly, but then it's the fastest. Once you want to find very good accuracy, it's the fastest of all the methods. However, and this is the final slide, the previous slide showed training error. That's not what you want to do. You want to do testing error. When you look at the test loss, now the SBRG method is in red. We see that it's a poor algorithm in terms of testing. It was a good algorithm in terms of training. Test error diminishes, and then it bounces, whereas the stochastic gradient method and the methods that we proposed, a very good testing out-of-sample performance. They're pretty much on top of each other. So to conclude, because I have some other remarks about something else, but they're too long. We are interested in a dynamic sampling algorithm that uses second order information. We have seen that it's producing some results that are really new for logistic regression. We are now in the process of testing them in the context of deep neural networks. And this is a difficult thing because there are lots of tricks that interfere. Batch normalization, other tricks like that make things difficult. On top of that, you have to make sure that you don't increase the sample too fast so the generalization properties are lost. So the state of the art is that some of us feel that optimization for machine learning is a really interesting field where much is to be discovered and will be useful there in other domains. Lots of questions arise, many, many questions arise, and it puts you in contact with a statistical learning community that's trying to understand what's happening with a machine learning community that is getting really good results. So it's interesting times, they're confusing times. That's the end of my presentation.
All right. Jorge, thank you very much for a very interesting presentation. We're running a little bit late, but I think we can accommodate for few questions or comments, and I see that Larry's just dying to ask you a question here. So, Larry, you want
Picking
to?
On me.
Yeah, no.
Well, okay. Ignacio loves to pick on me, so let me just ask a very maybe an interesting question that you said at the end, Jorge, and really enjoyed this talk very much, especially the way the results are evolving. And with the BFGS method, there's always this kind of classic thing that you mentioned several times about preserving convexity, and if you have non-convexity, that's something to watch out for. Can you give a kind of, in particular, that little term, rho, 1 over y transpose s, if that becomes negative, there has to be some kind of a correction thing done. And I assume that might actually relate to what you're talking about, fault detection. Can you give us a few ideas about what you're doing there?
Yes, exactly. I mean, you're asking the really most crucial part of about this, right? So we are now looking at stochastic line searches. This means now you have to do a noisy line search, and the line search is always has to return a Y transpose S to be positive. Mm-hmm. And what we do is, if it doesn't, we do a lengthening of the step. Mm-hmm. You know, when you have finite difference noise, you want to do larger finite differences. So the answer is we do some lengthening of the step. And that we can guarantee, you know, there's some trials, you will get that quantity to be positive.
Okay, thank you.
But that is not in any of our papers. We have not, this paper is being written now.
Okay, thank you, yeah.
Any other questions, comments here in the audience or out there? Anybody who's listening? Maybe, Jorge, one very general question. Given the fact that the neural networks can be, you know, rather complex in terms of, you know, the different polynomials and so forth, Can you comment on how serious the issue of convexity is? In other words, how non-convex are these problems, or is it reasonably safe to assume that the problems are largely convex? Any comments along those lines?
Well, they're definitely non-convex. There are multiple minimizers and nasty minimizers. Because the problem is overcapacitated, all the minimizers are degenerate, meaning that if you go to a minimizer, there are directions where the function is flat. And so there are families, there are whole manifolds of minimizers, they're stationary points, and the algorithm navigates itself through that domain. Non-convexity is definitely there.
In terms of the quality of solution that you get in a neural net, is it really that important at the end to try to get the, hopefully theoretical global optimum? Or is it okay to live with, some of these local minima?
It really appears to be related to robust minimizers versus non-robust minimizers, not global versus local.
Right.
So what we have observed, many people have observed, is that you get similar training errors, but you may go to, some algorithms can get to minimizers that are sharp and minimizers that are wide. A better language is robust minimizers.
Right.
If you have an objective, if you have an objective function that has two minimizers, one of them is a wide basin and the other one that has a very sharp basin, if this function that you're minimizing is a proxy, it's not the real one, you want to find the minimizer that is wide, because the objective function you want to minimize is similar to that one, not precisely that one, right? So people have talked about global versus local. I try very hard to see if there is a difference. I think it's about robust versus non-robust. I'm pretty sure about this.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. All right, any other last questions? Okay, well, Jorge, thank you so much for a really very interesting and stimulating talk. Really enjoyed it also very much. And again, really appreciate very much your talk then. Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity. Nice to see you.